Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. New Books and Psychology Podcast. My name is Karen Messina. I'm a psychologist, psychoanalyst, author, podcast host, and the new chair of the scholarship and writing section of the Department of Psychoanalytic Education, which is part of the American Psychoanalytic Association. The bigger news is today I have a great pleasure, or is my great pleasure, to introduce a writer and scholar. His name is Austin Ratner. Austin grew up in the Cleveland area and attended the University of Michigan. He also received a medical degree from Johns Hopkins University. After medical school, he made an interesting switch and decided to become a fiction writer in the search of truth and beauty versus the medical route. So currently, Austin has taken on a new role as the editor of the American Psychoanalyst magazine, also called TAP, and is doing a fantastic job with a new concept he and his team have developed. So I could say a lot more about Austin's many talents, but let's hear it from him about his wishes to increase the visibility of psychoanalysis by broadening the scope of issues that psychoanalysis can actually help solve. So asked Austin, what are some of the key strategies you are trying to accomplish with this new design?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me back on your podcast. This is my second time here. And I loved talking with you the first time. So the strategies for the question was the strategies for bringing attention to psychoanalysis through TAP. So the first thing that I have tried to do is change the look of TAP to update it a bit and to reorient the content a little bit. TAP has had a long history before I became editor of publishing some great writing about psychoanalysis, but it was also a more inward-facing publication, more like a association newsletter. And I don't think it had been updated in terms of its look for some time. It didn't really have a lot of visuals or any art with it. So we decided to expand to full color, and the art director, who's a good friend of mine, Austin Hughes, has done an amazing job with the art. And he brought on Melissa Overton, who is the former creative director of the MoMA Design Store and an experienced magazine designer. And she's also done just an amazing job at sort of making the pages of the magazine into something really dynamic and eye-catching and fresh looking. And in terms of the content, I've had a couple different ideas that I've begun to put into practice. One of them was to hire some professional writers to do some of the writing, and when possible, to introduce the journalists to psychoanalysts and create some dialogue with the experts on psychoanalysis and then the experts at writing, especially for lay people. And the idea was to make TAP potentially of interest to people who don't already know about psychoanalysis, to try to use this as a vehicle for not just members of the American Psychoanalytic Association to talk to one another about their very interesting work, but to share that interesting work and psychoanalytic perspectives with a broader audience. So bringing in some professional writers was one strategy, and the choice of topics has also been a strategy to try to connect with certain zeitgeisty subject matter with some pop cultural subject matter. I interviewed the villain in the movie Guardians of the Galaxy Part 3. His name is Chuck Woody Awuji. He's a Nigerian born actor who is also a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company, and he is absolutely brilliant. And we had this amazing discussion about acting and acting in Marvel movies and the psychology of supervillains. We talked about Freud's paper on character types met with in psychoanalysis and how Freud talks about criminality from a sense of guilt. And Chuck was really into that idea in terms of getting into the psychology of a villain. So that's just one example of content that, I thought could potentially have broader appeal. Now we have to build out our ability to let audiences know about TAP in the first place. And we're in the process of doing that and have various strategies for publicity, but we're only two issues in.
Yeah, I think that it really is a great asset to TAP that you really are a Freudian scholar. I mean, I'm sure that you read all volumes many times. I mean, that shows in your book, your last book.
I can't claim to have read the entire standard edition, but I've read a lot of it. I've read a lot of Freud.
Well, in your book, Psychoanalysis and Aversion to Proof, it's clear that you've read a lot. Mm-hmm. So that it's great that you could pull in some of Freud's ideas about culture, art, in addition to psychoanalysis, literature.
Yes. Yeah, and we like to sprinkle in as pull quotes some of Freud's commentary on whatever because he talked about everything. I mean, his work touched on everything. So no matter what the topic is, you can find something interesting that Freud had to say about it.
Yeah, it's funny that I've said that quite a bit, usually in the context of therapy, but when people say something about some new theory, I usually say, well, that's interesting. However, just about everything that's said about any kind of therapy, there's some kernel of something in Freud, and in addition to a lot of other topics. So, yeah, I totally get that. Another question about digital presence. People just can't have print material these days. What are you doing with that? Who do you have?
Yes.
Have a group.
Good question. So, you know, I almost, my initial suggestion when I applied for this job and met with the search committee and they wanted a proposal for how to reimagine TAP. So it wasn't all my idea to reimagine it. The search committee of the organization invited a reimagining of TAP, and I've just, you know, pitch them my vision, and they, for better or worse, went with it. And but when I pitched them my proposal, I actually suggested doing away with the print edition and going wholly digital, because people, that's the way people really consume any kind of journalistic content. So I thought, you know, save the money on printing and plow it into the art and the content and the outreach. Because printing, especially printing an art magazine, is not as cheap as one would like it to be. So, you know, after getting a little bit of feedback and that people like the print magazine, Melissa Overton also liked the idea of keeping a print magazine because it is a beautiful object that she and Austin have created. I mean, so it's nice to, I as a writer, I always like to have a physical book. As a reader, I like to have a physical book. So we decided to at least start with to retain a print edition. But we do have a website also. You can, that's TAPORG, TAPMAG, .org, TAPMAG, .org. And you know, we hired a web designer who has experience working with Squarespace, which is sort of an off the shelf website building app and platform. And she's done an amazing job with it. I think it looks exactly as I had hoped. And we will be loading all of our content online. Right now it is primarily the content from our first issue, content from the second issue, and the next one will be posted. And when it's posted, we then promote it on social media. Michelle Rada, the director of public affairs at APSA, has been great about boosting our posts on social media to make the membership of the association aware of it. The idea in the long run is to use social media and perhaps certain other strategies like news aggregators, getting some of our original journalism covered by mainstream media, possibly.
Right.
But whatever publicity strategy we have, we'll put them together for individual articles and then try to get interest in those individual articles that'll bring people to the website and bring people to psychoanalysis as a topic. You know, a lot of people, as news consumption changes, a lot of people are consuming news through newsletters. Even though newsletter sounds like something old fashioned, you know, I'm sure you know, there's all these newsletters available digitally on Substack.
I have one actually.
And you have your own one. I know. I'm subscribed to it. You know, I've watched the model of certain writers of newsletters and how they have been able to grab national attention by getting coverage from mainstream media for some of their original reporting. And so an example of that is Judd Legum, who I'm blanking on the name of his Popular Information. It's the name of his newsletter and his Substack. And I came across him on Twitter in 2020, shortly after the January 6th insurrection. And he is the one that broke the story about the corporations declaring that they had paused or stopped donating to members of Congress who had objected to certifying the election results, which became a huge national story. It was his original, and he's got a very small staff. It's just him. I interviewed him for an article I wrote for the Jewish Daily Forward a few years ago. And I learned about how he works. It's him and one or two assistants, does the lion's share of the reporting himself. And he and his assistant called 80 or so, or I don't know how many it was, 80 to 100, 100 something companies, and just asked them, do you intend to continue to support these candidates who objected to the certification of the election and are, you know, essentially voting against democracy by having done that? And then this became a huge story, got picked up all over the place. And then many more people became aware of his newsletter. My thought is that we could get some journalists to do some original muckraking reporting that could be of interest to mainstream media. You know, what I like about the idea of newsletters and independent journalism is that you don't have to sit there and wait for the mainstream media to decide what to cover. And if the psychoanalytic community is going to sit around and wait for coverage in a passive way, it's never going to happen. You know, as you know, and as we've actually discussed, and the last time I was on your podcast, psychoanalysis has gone through a period of marginalization and has been kind of swept out of the national conversation in so many different ways. So to get back into that conversation where psychoanalysis, in my view, is desperately needed for so many different reasons, I think it's on us, it's on people that have some understanding of psychoanalysis to try to influence the conversation and not passively wait for the media to choose what to say. If Judd Legum had passively waited for somebody else to cover January 6th, and he often talks about this, the mainstream media has certain narratives that they favor, and they don't look at other narratives. And so he's all about looking at things that the mainstream media are not necessarily talking about, but ought to be, in his view. And he finds a way to make it into a story. And now, granted, writing about January 6th is a sexier story, perhaps, than, you know, writing about psychoanalysis. But psychoanalysis has so many connections to and so many applications to so much that's going on that's topical in the world today. And furthermore, I think there's a lot of the story of why psychoanalysis has been marginalized and how it is making its comeback is a story worth telling and trying to get people interested in. So, yeah, as usual, I've left your question so far in the past. I can't remember what it was, but hopefully I spoke to it.
You answered plenty. I like that you're talking about bringing in so many other things. I mean, in this edition, you probably know all these things by heart, but obviously, racism is something that's talked about or written about, psychoanalysis and its discontent, a gay patient's reflection. I mean, they're kind of pulling things from various places, which really is society in general. So I think
really good. Yeah, and thinking about what it means to be a diverse population with minority perspectives, and how to be sensitive to them, how to empathize with them, how to help people coming from minority backgrounds when you're not of that background. All those things are so important in psychoanalysis. I think the conversation is impoverished without a psychoanalytic perspective in considering race and considering prejudice and considering what it's like to grow up in the face of prejudice.
Well, they selected the right editor, that's for sure, to get the message out there. A new question. Betsy, we've talked about this before. You used to feel pretty passionate about the fact that research was needed, that it had to get on that track, or
yep,
could be a thing of the past. Are you still thinking in that way?
Yes. So one of the main sections of the magazine, I've kind of divided it up into some rudimentary categories. Research is one of the main ones. I think we have research, arts and culture, education, and we have a category called stories from life, which is really hearing from patients, basically telling about their struggles, telling about some mental health, you know, struggle, and then inviting some commentary from a psychoanalyst or a psychoanalytic psychologist to give added context and perspective. So the research section, yeah, I'm committed to covering some research related topic in every, at least one article in every issue. And so the first one was written by two researchers at Austin Riggs. And it was about the use of measurement-based care in a psychoanalytic inpatient setting. And the second one was an interview with Sheldon Solomon, who is a psychology professor at Skidmore, about his decades of research into death anxiety and defenses against it. And this is, I'm realistic about an ambitious, idealistic project. I don't know whether I will succeed at expanding the scope of TAP to reach people beyond APSA. I hope I will. I expect I will. I'm going to try as hard as I can, but it may not work. But people do need to know about the research that has been done and is being done to validate some of the core principles of psychoanalysis, because that narrative is still dominant out there, the counter narrative, which is completely false, that, quote, Freud has been discredited, or psychoanalysis is, you know, a thing of the past, is only of historical interest. And this stuff is repeated all the time. It's repeated by people who consider themselves allies of psychoanalysis. It's become a cultural meme. And one of the ways that I think it's important to kind of slow down the momentum of that meme, of the replication of that meme, and to change what is said about psychoanalysis, is to call attention to the work that has been done validating both its theories and its therapeutic efficacy. So I'm absolutely devoted to publishing in every issue something about research that is being done, has been done, and is going to be done, and then trying my best to call attention to it, outside of call the attention of people outside of psychoanalysis and outside of APSA so that they can learn about it. One population of people I would love to get this magazine TAP in front of is psychology students. I would love for them to be able to just browse through it, have some exposure to a psychoanalytic point of view and exposure to the evidence base for psychoanalytic ideas like defense mechanisms. And Sheldon Solomon has provided a fantastic and very capacious, big evidence base for defense mechanisms with his social psychology studies that he's done over a period of now like 30 years. I'd love for psychology students to know about that. And I think they'd be interested. And I think that they also might be open to the notion that their own professors have a particular point of view. And if it's a completely non-psychoanalytic point of view, that might not be the final word. You know, I think students are interested in questioning and in, regarding their own teachers and the institutions where they study with a little bit of skepticism. That's a healthy part of being a curious student. And psychoanalysis is still a young and revolutionary science. And I think it's exciting for people once they actually crack a book and see what, you know, Sigmund Freud had to really say and what current psychoanalysts are really doing and what they are really about. I mean.
Yeah, I just had another thought in terms of a population. A lot of people who go to social work school and graduate end up doing analytic training, or at least a fair amount of candidates come from that background. So that might be another, like social work schools that might.
Absolutely. And that's so funny that you say that, because we have an article in the forthcoming issue that is all about the history of social work and psychoanalysis. And actually, one of the implicit points of view of the writer of this article is that the American Psychoanalytic Association really needs to be more aggressive about inviting social workers into the organization. And I mean, social workers are the exact number, the exact percentage is cited in this forthcoming article, and I don't remember it, but social workers do most of the psychotherapy in this country. I mean, and I happen to have a soft spot for social workers. My mom is a social worker. My grandmother, who you have heard about, was a social worker. My aunt is a psychoanalyst and a social worker. And so I was kind of raised by social workers. And I also, I love the ethos of social work, because social workers know how to think about groups. It's part of their training. They know how to, they're not afraid to think about the application of psychoanalytic ideas to social problems, which is, you know, something that for a long time psychoanalysis did not do that much, you know, maybe in pockets, but sporadic and limited. And I also think that so many social workers that I encounter are so practical. Their jobs are often demand of them that they are looking for practical solutions. And I think that this is a moment in the history of psychoanalysis to get real practical. It's a moment in the history of humanity to get real practical and think of some implementable psychological solutions to the problems that we face, so many of which are fundamentally psychological. Climate, I know, is of interest to you. And while climate is a meteorological problem, the solution is a psychological solution.
Really?
To get past the denial and also to figure out how to cooperate together and unite behind you know, doing what we have to do to keep our home planet safe to live on.
Right. I also do a podcast for the Climate Psychology Alliance of North America. And they're into things like eco grief, eco anxiety. So it all does tie in together.
I have another article in the forthcoming issue that is about psychoanalytic solutions to the climate crisis. It's right. It's by Alan Karbelnig. He's a do you know him? He's in LA, a psychoanalyst in LA.
Well, to switch gears a little bit, but probably not really. I think you might remember that I have a passion for making one particular psychoanalytic concept a household word, which is projective identification. It's not me, it's you kind of idea, always blame shifting. Mm-hmm. I continue with this passion because I think it applies to the problem with racism that's, you know, it's around the globe, populist global politics, et cetera, et cetera. What other concepts in psychoanalysis do you think would speak to people in other fields?
Well, you know, certain psychoanalytic concepts are already invoked all the time. And I mean, I just, during the Trump presidency, I listened to Nancy Pelosi say he's projecting onto the Democrats. You know, I mean, this stuff is it's in circulation among lay people, even if it's not the current gospel of academic psychology. But I think that at this point, many people are familiar, maybe not with projective identification, but with the idea of projection, at least.
Yeah.
They're familiar with the idea of being defensive. Denial is in a headline every other day. Denial is always, to me, one of the simplest ways of explaining to someone what psychoanalysis is about. Everyone's at this point kind of familiar with the concept of denial, that somebody might not want to believe something that is anxiety provoking or unpleasant. And that's common sense to most people. And it's a really easy entry point into the whole idea of the unconscious and defense mechanisms. So I always find denial is already familiar to people, and it's something that we all are extremely concerned about right now. I mean, you have climate denial, you had people denying medical facts during COVID, you have election denial, and you mentioned the interview that I did in my second issue with Philippe Copeland, who is a professor of social work, who talks about racism denial.
Absolutely.
As soon as I came across his writing on racism denial, I thought I would love to have him in the magazine, because there's an example of an application of psychoanalytic thinking about defenses to something so germane to what we're struggling with as a society.
There's one thing that Copeland says that, he said a lot of interesting things, but I was really struck by the fact that he said he thought a number of people would do things right, but they frequently don't know what that means or how to do it. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, he has worked with the Center for Anti-Racist Research in educating people on how to deal with racism. And so, you know, one of his philosophies I gather from having interviewed him and read his work is that people require a certain amount of education about psychology to understand what racism is and how to handle it, how to handle it when it might arise in oneself, when you see it in another person. It's not necessarily intuitive to know exactly what to do. We're saddled with the burden of, as he says, living in a society that is scarred by a very toxic history of racism that's been we talked, he's African American, and we talked a lot of what we talked about focus on racism against African Americans. The pain experienced by that community is so great, and understanding, keeping in mind the pain of racism, I think, and getting educated about how to talk to someone else who is in pain. I think that that's an example of the process of getting educated around racism from a psychological perspective and it being useful in negotiating it. He talks about, I think it's useful to be educated about the concept of denial because we're all inclined to not want to see ourselves as racist. So without the concept of denial, it's hard to get your head around the fact that you can mean well and you could still do certain things that are racist. you could actually act or say things in that are racist, even if you don't mean to. And
Absolutely,
it's an invitation to introspection, to which is, I think, incredibly important. It's empathy for other people, but also doing a little bit of introspection and what am I feeling actually in this setting where something has happened that feels racial, that feels like some type of what the Holmes Commission calls a racial enactment.
Yeah.
When it feels like some kind of racial enactment is going on, some psychological forces related to race are influencing how we're interacting with each other in some setting. It happens constantly. I think I see it all the time. I see it from the perspective of a white person. I don't have the burden of experiencing it from the point of view of a person of color. But I just want to acknowledge that. So the question was, I think, about how Dr. Copeland sees education in, it's about emotional literacy, I think. And
absolutely. I was struck that he said people might do the right, or he thinks people would do the right thing.
If they knew how, yeah.
Yeah, they don't know how.
Yeah. Another piece of that is also, I think, just feeling so helpless in the face of something so big. And what he talks about is how to work it out in a sort of local way, we can have a positive impact on the problem of racism just in our own relationships, and that's one of the things that I think he really has a lot of wise advice and insights about how to do that.
In terms of wise advice or thinking, in the article that you wrote, you say that diversity takes work, and that's so important. That's definitely something that needs to be highlighted with yellow highlight or whatever color many, many times, because it's so important. It's not, we're going to have this course and now everybody is enlightened. It doesn't work that way. I wonder if you could, on that note, I wonder if you could say a little bit about the Holmes Commission report, because people, you mentioned it, I don't, people don't know what that is, and yet it's such an important piece of work.
Yeah. So I read the Holmes report, the final version of the report of the Holmes Commission, and what and Dorothy Holmes is a psychoanalyst in I believe in DC. She chaired the commission. The commission looked at I think it looked at the perception of race and race relations and racism in psychoanalytic institutes. I can't tell you off the top of my head exactly what their methodology was, but I think it was doing interviews and surveys and
Was research definitely involved.
They did a huge amount of research, and they had a lot of data. And then the writing of it, it's a beautiful piece of writing. I mean, it's like a rhetorically powerful document, and says so many things that I think need to be part of the national conversation about race. What we touched on before about racial enactments, this idea that something suppressed feelings, on an individual basis, suppressed feelings about race can burst out into action. If they're not acknowledged in your thinking, they can find their way out through action. And the Holmes Commission talks about how that happens on an individual level and on a cultural level too. And so this notion of enactments where unconscious racism leads unconscious feelings about racism lead to distortions of our corruptions of our actions with one another. I think it's so important to be thinking about all of this in a psychoanalytic way, and it's exactly what they're doing. And I think that it's wonderful that I think it seems to me that APSA has done a good job of heralding the Holmes Commission report, but I really want people outside of APSA to know about it. I want people to see, look at the amazing work that is being done with a psychoanalytic lens, how indispensable these insights are to actually healing, to beginning to heal the wounds of racism, you know?
Yeah, I one thing I liked to the Holmes Commission was, there was something about, I don't have the exact quote, but a gateway to psychoanalytic understanding could really help people understand and then do something about or remove obstacles of systemic racism. I mean, to see it and to stop it, that's pretty powerful, which is from the Holmes Commission. Mm-hmm. So we have to open more windows so people can see what we have to offer.
Yeah, and you know, my assumption is that, like, for example, Dr. Copeland, who I interviewed about racism denial, my assumption is he probably doesn't know about the Holmes report. Next time I talk to him, I'm going to make sure to say, hey, you know, love to get your reaction to this. That's part of the mission of TAP, in my view, is to open up dialogue between psychoanalytic practitioners and thinkers, and then people who are not as formally identified with psychoanalysis, but may take a lot of interest in these ideas.
Well, as I recall, I think he's a university professor, right? So
yeah, he's a professor at Boston University. That's where the Center for Anti-Racist Research is housed.
So people like Dr. Copeland are perfect people we want to get interested in.
And the Center for Anti-Racist Research is also a very interesting place to me in terms of their attempt to shift a national conversation and the way that they go about trying to get their ideas across. They do a collaboration with the Boston Globe called The Emancipator, and it is essentially a magazine that, you know, like TAP, has intellectual viewpoints and thinking about race and racism and reporting from their point of view. And then they are working with the Boston Globe to get it out to people. So that is in a way an inspiration to me, an idea of how to take a group of ideas that I think need to get out into the mainstream, and then seek collaboration with people outside of psychoanalysis to get that message out.
Well, now I have a very pragmatic question. The magazine is beautiful. Your goals and strategies sound fantastic. It looks like a very sophisticated magazine with great material and with not a lot of advertising. What about fundraising? That's my question.
Yes. So yeah, fundraising is part of the plan for sure. We have had good support from APSA, so they are paying a big chunk of our bills. But it's also, you know, the people that I brought in, I have some people who have really illustrious careers in marketing and the arts, and they are working at way below their market value. And so that's, you know, what I've heard referred to as low bono work. As pro bono is free and low bono is for something, but at a lower rate. And so we absolutely need money. I mean, we've begun to do some fundraising outreach, but we haven't really gotten started yet. But you know, one thing that we do is we just make sure to communicate to the reader that this is a nonprofit enterprise, and it's for a good cause, and we need money to make it work. And so we have a donate button on every article on the website, and we have gotten some donations that way. The idea is to do what The Guardian does, where they let you know that it's like to keep providing independent journalism, you know, we need your support. That's one strategy to raise money. And I would like to hold some fundraisers.
That'd be great.
And to find, you know, philanthropic donors to support what we're doing. And, you know, we really haven't begun to. It's been such a heavy lift to get this very ambitious project underway, to change TAP so drastically and to try to bring on so much content that from so many different sources. And it's a lot to do all at once, to have it the first website and then to do the first social media outreach. And the fundraising is another thing that's on my radar and on my plate. But so far, basically, we're just doing a little bit of begging for money on the website.
Well, this is a good time of year for people to give to TAP or anything else, since it's a tax deduction. So,
yes. So if this were an NPR. They call it a telephone still? I don't know.
Where they ask for money.
I humbly ask for your support. If you like what we're doing, we need the support.
Yeah. Well, you're doing a terrific job. So I hope people get that message. I know that you have something in JAPA, I think, where you're going to. Is there anything you'd like to say about that? It's a book. It's a review of your book, right?
Yes, the current issue of JAPA has a review of my book, The Psychoanalyst's Aversion to Proof. I haven't read the review. I know who wrote it. Peter Rednitsky. I haven't read it, so I can't comment on the review, but I think it is a good, I'm pleased that JAPA is paying attention to the book and the ideas in the book. I think that is the important thing. I mean, that book originated as a paper, which the first place I submitted it to was JAPA. And I have to say, I've been rejected many, many times. I've never been rejected with that level of hostility. I've never seen reviews like that. So it's good to see that these ideas have prevailed in finally reaching the pages of JAPA in some form.
Well, you have a prize in literature, as I recall. So what is the prize that you, was it for your last book, the one before?
I love talking about my prizes because that makes me feel important. So even though prizes don't really make you important, but I won the Rohr Prize for Jewish Literature in 2011 for my first novel, The Jump Artist. That is certainly the biggest monetary prize I've ever won. It was a $100,000 award. And
it's a great book. I mean, how you wove in fiction with facts. Obviously there's an art to that, but it's beautifully written.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's kind of psychohistory in a way. I mean, I don't know if that's the right word for it, but it is based on a true story about a real person, Philippe Halsman.
Yeah. I've been telling people, I didn't use a shortened version to go to the website or to see this magazine that I keep talking about. It's the American Psychoanalyst .org, I believe, right?
The americanpsychoanalyst.org or tapmag.org. They both work.
Great. So do you have anything else you'd like to share with people today?
I don't think so, but I love talking to you, and you're very gracious and very, you never put me on the hot seat, and I appreciate that.
Well, I want to reiterate, you and your team have done a great job in reconceptualizing TAP. It was fine. It was a fine source of information before. I thought of it as an expanded newsletter in a way.
Yes.
This is art. And well,
thank you very much. I guess that is one thing I'd like to add is just that I didn't in announcing bold changes to TAP and expressing my enthusiasm for a bold new agenda with TAP, I have never meant to denigrate what came before at all. And I know that that TAP before I got to it achieved some very important things in the history of the organization. And all due respect to everyone who came before me and was doing that work on a totally volunteer basis while seeing patients. And I've read, I wrote for the old TAP, and I've read amazing articles in the old TAP. So I certainly don't want my enthusiasm for the new TAP to be understood as any kind of denigration of the old TAP.
I haven't heard anything that you've said that would suggest that. It's just a new day, a new way of reaching people. I mean, the idea of telling stories to get other people interested in other fields, I think is really important.
I forgot that's actually, I didn't mention that, but that is also one of the main ideas about making the content accessible is always telling a story. As much as possible, always telling a story.
Well, thank you very much. Come back anytime.